Welcome to Addiction Nonfiction, hosted by family recovery advocate and writer Annie Highwater. This is a podcast of real conversations and true stories from people who have been affected by or active in addiction. Each episode will tell real, raw, sometimes unbelievable stories, opening up the lives of various guests. The goal is to take a deep look into topics related to addiction, alcoholism, family dysfunction, codependency, and other various types of madness, the real life stuff we all experience. You can reach Annie by emailing annieunhooked@gmail.com. And now, enjoy the show.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. I am super excited for this week's guest. I have been hoping to get a firefighter paramedic on the show who can talk about what they're seeing and experiencing out in the city, people who are on the front lines of this epidemic and what's going on in our culture and local communities. So I have asked Assistant Chief Chris Menapace from the Whitehall Fire Department to come on. He has a wealth of experience and knowledge. He began his fire career in 1997 with the Homer Volunteer Fire Department, shortly after joining the Utica Volunteer Emergency Squad, and began his full-time career with the Mount Vernon Fire Department in 1999. In 2007, Chris was appointed the Assistant Chief of the Mount Vernon Fire Department and began duties as the fire chief in the summer of 2010. In 2013, he left Mount Vernon Fire and began his tenure as the assistant chief for the Whitehall Division of Fire. He is married to Bridget for 25 years. They have four kids. And interestingly enough, he enjoys officiating high school athletics. So I'm curious to know how all of that blends together. So that said, Chris, thank you so much and welcome on the show. I cannot wait to ask you some questions. I really appreciate you coming on.
Well, you know, Annie, it's great to be here. The officiating things actually started before the fire career. Baseball was a big family sport growing up. That was I didn't have a father growing up, so
really
didn't have a father. It was my mother and my brother and I, and we ended up moving in with grandma at the second half of my third grade year. Yeah, it was third grade. I believe it was third grade. So mom was always, you know, chasing it, trying to do the best with my brother and I. But there was always baseball. And one of my uncles was really good at baseball, and he really loved the sport. And it was a way for me to bond with my uncle, the father figure. And then the other uncle was big into hunting, so that's he kind of taught me how to hunt. So, but the baseball really took off. I enjoyed it. I actually started to umpire baseball in high school on the weekends for the Little League games. I went to college on a scholarship between athletics and my grades. I did pretty well in school, and I was able to go to Walsh College. It was a college back then, wasn't a university, on a baseball scholarship. But I got hurt. I got hurt my freshman year, blew out my knee. I was a catcher. So I ended up coming back home and going to Kent State. And that's where I met my wife. And after we got married, I started taking umpiring pretty seriously. Actually went to a couple camps. I was offered a scholarship to go down to Florida to professional umpire school. I finished in one of the qualifying camps down in South Carolina. I finished in the top three, but I turned it down. We had two small children by that time, and I was pretty convinced that I wasn't going to have mama raise the kids by herself while I was bouncing around ballparks all summer. So, I don't do any college ball anymore. I used to do a lot of college baseball. But I do work a full slate of high school baseball games. And then I'm a football Friday night ref, because who doesn't like under the lights football Friday night?
Well, let me ask you, how do you keep your cool when someone freaks out on you or yells and gets aggressive?
Well, baseball is easier because I feel a lot more comfortable in baseball. Football is a lot more tense. There's a lot more they're a lot more amped up in football. The coaches are all amped up and the players are all amped up. Baseball's a much calmer game, so
yeah,
it's easier in baseball. But bottom line is, you just let it go in one ear and out the other. Understand that it doesn't really matter what they say. I'm right.
You got me.
I got the rule book on my side. Right. So,
Has someone ever taken a swing at you?
No. We had some real tense games over the years. I had the Canton McKinley Hilliard Davidson game a few years ago. That was intense. I had the Steubenville Dover playoff game a few years ago. That was intense. We had a big one 2 weeks ago up in Knox County. We had East Knox and Northmore, and they're both 6-0 coming in. And, we took a score off the scoreboard on an offensive pass interference. So, the home team usually doesn't like stuff like that. But, no, nobody's ever swung at me or anything like that. People usually toe the line.
Well, yeah, it's clear, though. You know your way around the public. So,
it worked out well for me because when I started my career as a firefighter, we worked 24 hours on and 48 hours off.
Yeah.
So in those 2 days off, I could officiate, especially when I was doing a lot of college ball when my two older boys were young. You know, I'd leave, leave in the morning on a Tuesday and go work an afternoon doubleheader at one school and come home and work an evening game at another school the following night or another doubleheader and then go back into the firehouse. So I really kind of had to step back away from college once I got on 40-hour shift. Well, they say it's 40 hours, but it's 7 o'clock and I'm still in my office. So.
Those are some great hours, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you're a firefighter and a paramedic, is that right? Because I know
that's correct.
Sometimes it's separate, right?
Yeah, sometimes it's separate. The Franklin County model, it's pretty rare not to be dual certified. Now, your bigger departments can get away with it, but the mid to small size departments such as us, the vast majority of us are dual certified simply because the municipality or the townships, they get a more rounded employee and we can perform a lot more skills for the same money.
Yeah. So that said, clearly we're in an epidemic, and I think Ohio is supposed to be where the first fentanyl overdose was, and it's been pretty bad here. I don't know if you're familiar with the book Dreamland that was written about Ohio.
So I'm very much familiar with it. Read the book, loved the book. And then as part of one of our programs that we're going to talk about, hopefully we get to it on the podcast this evening. I actually reached out to Sam and told him what project I was working on and why. And we got to emailing back and forth, and then it escalated to a couple phone calls. He called me out of the blue on a Thursday in the spring and said, "Hey, I'm flying into Columbus tomorrow, and my evening plans were canceled. Is there any way you could meet me for supper?" I mean, how do you say no to that one? I will tell you, that's been the easiest phone call to mama in 25 years of saying, "Hey, honey, I'm not going to make it home for supper tonight."
I bet. So he's actually coming on the podcast next week. I'm super excited because his work here is second to none.
Oh, phenomenal. He's absolutely phenomenal. So I got to pick his brain we were at Rusty Buckets for an hour and a half. And we ended up talking, and I was able to obtain enough money and enough funding, and we brought him to town. And he was he was the keynote speaker in the big opiate fair that we had this past spring.
Like to see more of those.
Yes, we got a few more scheduled. So
good.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, and brilliant work. Tell me, what are you seeing on your daily runs? Tell me what those are like. What's your day look like as far as opiates are related?
So first of all, we're a very busy firehouse. We're typically one of the 50th busiest firehouses in the nation. Wow. Year after year after year. We are a small city, 5.2 square miles.
Wow.
But we have 18,000 people. So when you look at the state of Ohio demographically, the average census per square mile in Ohio is right around 250. It's like 248 people. Whitehall has 3,456 per square mile. So we are packed in like sardines. We are extremely diverse community. There's 9 different languages spoken at our high school.
Wow.
So, we like to consider ourselves a little city with big city problems. So my guys turn anywhere between 22 and 26 calls every day out of the firehouse. Each call lasts approximately an hour. So it's only a 24-hour shift. So that lets you know how busy we get. So, you know, we were seeing, you know, three to four overdoses a week the last two and a half years. Actually the last 3 years. And that's what prompted us reaching out and starting this project, because when you look at Whitehall per capita, we were seeing a disproportionate amount of overdoses. When you look at our population, we shouldn't have had as many as we do. So once we really got inside the numbers, we realized that, you know, of course, Ohio is still number two in the nation for deaths by overdose and overdose rates. Franklin County is always in the top five of worst counties. And per capita, Whitehall has five times higher the overdose rate than Franklin County average. So we were seeing a lot of it. The only drug that we pushed more often in the last 2 years was Combivent, which is a bronchodilator that we use to open up the bronchioles when somebody's having problem breathing. So your shortness of breath for your elderly. That is the only drug that we gave more often than Narcan.
Oh, okay.
So tremendous. We've given over 450 doses of Narcan in the last 2 years.
Wow. So how many would you say you're seeing a week now?
It's well, some weeks it drops, some weeks it doesn't. So we're averaging, we're averaging about 1.5 to 2. We'd like to think it's because of our programming that we've done.
Yeah.
But we're also, as part of this program, we've really fine-tuned and worked into the fold some better documentation and better tracking mechanism. So I honestly believe that we're getting real data and good, reliable data now. And I think the data that we were getting previously was likely understated, if you can believe it. So I feel it getting better and slowing down, but I definitely don't see it going away. And with the insurgence of this fentanyl, you know, when the surges happen, then it just affects us all.
So as far as what you're seeing, can you tell me, like, what's the youngest overdose you've seen? What's the oldest? What are some of the dynamics of the people you're seeing?
So, you know, it's been a while since me personally ride the trucks, right? I'm a fire chief in Franklin County. And so when we jump on trucks, we make everybody else nervous. The guys, right? We're the sayers and they're the doers. But right. I can remember when I was on the truck, you know, we still had overdoses. I personally, the youngest overdose I had, there was a kid in high school. He's a sophomore in high school, is the youngest one that I've ever had to intubate. Because we the Narcan didn't bring them around. Our guys here, I think, you know, we haven't seen an elementary student. We have seen some high school students. We have seen some elderly, like you wouldn't, like a 70, 72-year-old we've had. So, you know, this is one of those phenomenons, scourges that is non-discriminatory.
And are you able to revive most, or how?
We are. We unfortunately lost, I think we've lost 9 already this year, which we're right on track. So hopefully that slows down, but we have lost 9 already, but we've been able to bring back over 100 other ones. And some of the components of our program, our police department is very active in helping us now. 2 years ago, we went to them and we said, hey, here's this cool new drug for you guys. It's called Narcan. Let us teach you how to use it. And if you get there, shove it up their nose and push the button. And they've done it. And last year alone, they brought 30 back before we even got there. We also use our community paramedic pretty aggressively. He went out to all the schools. We provided all the schools in our area Project Dawn kits and educated 3 staff members at each building. And believe it or not, one day last fall, so about a year ago, There was a mom that dropped a child, two children off to elementary school, and she actually overdosed in the lot before she left, right there at the elementary school. So as the squad was getting there, as the medics were getting there, the staff member, the teacher, was actually getting ready to administer the Narcan to the parent. So that program's already paid off for us.
Yeah. So, and then when you guys treat somebody for an overdose, is there anything in place for the bystanders? And, you know, because sometimes the affected family, they're traumatized. Do you guys have anything in place, or do you direct them any certain way?
So what we do is we offer them to call the firehouse if you know, it depends on the scene. So if it's a chaotic scene, because you have to understand sometimes these occur in bad neighborhoods and there's not a lot of time or let's just be honest, there's not a lot of time and interest from the public that's there for us to work on social skills. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
They don't want us there any more than we want to be there.
Yeah.
So we get in, we get out, we take care of the patient, and we go from there. But when we are on scenes that are conducive and the staffing is right, then what happens is the education does occur. We offer them to stop by the firehouse, and then we give them, you know, business cards and pamphlets and documents of people that they could call for services.
Yeah, and there's so much more support now, and support groups and family organizations, and there's a lot that are at the fingertips of families that they didn't have before.
Yeah, you got the Prevention Action Alliance, you got TAP United.
Yeah.
You know, we got the Whitehall CAP. There's just a tremendous number, and when you sit down with these people, and when you network with these people to build this resource list, you just can't imagine how real they are and how passionate they are about what they do. And, you know, when you look at us, you know, I'm the typical looking firefighter, you know, I'm bald, I got a mustache, you know what I mean? I got a square jaw. I mean, yes, I understand the soft skills of taking care of patients. Yes, I do have the appropriate level of bedside manner, but that is not our specialty.
Yeah, right.
We are the jack of all trades. We have to be able to you know, do cardiac arrests because somebody's had 76 birthdays, as well as wake up the drug overdoses, as well as unchoke grandma, as well as cut a car door off when somebody's trapped. So, you know, we have to specialize in so many different areas. It makes it extremely difficult for us to master any. And sometimes those soft skills, those social, those wraparound services, like I like to refer to them, sometimes we don't get the opportunity to do it. So when these TAP United and, and WCAP.
Send them to us. Send them to all of, I mean, we all usually work in unison. So we are, there's so many more people affected than there are addicted. There's an ocean of need of family and loved ones. And we are, there's so many of us that are on the front lines of helping family. So definitely, I love that that's in place.
Yeah, I mean, we just, and I'm glad you said that, because this epidemic, we haven't just lost one generation. We are already down two. There are a tremendous number of grandparents in Franklin County that are raising their grandchildren.
I just had that conversation last night. It's phenomenal. And I mean, people in their 70s and 80s that are taking care of a 5-year-old and a 5-month-old, and they're desperately stressed out.
So I had a 52-year-old safe station run, and then we'll get inside all this, I'm sure, but I had a 52-year-old last week, and she has two children. Her son is in prison for years. It's like 20 more years. Her daughter has fled the state because of, you know, warrants.
Yeah.
And her mother dropped her off here. So here's a 71-year-old woman giving me a big old hug with tears in her eyes, because I'm helping her 52-year-old daughter, and she can't stay because she has to go pick up her great-grandchildren from daycare.
Yeah.
So great-grandchildren. So that is a family that has lost three generations to this epidemic.
It is so far reaching and it bleeds into the family system like nothing, nothing else. You're so right. And I want to get right to the fact that I love the Safe Station and WHO programs. I know it was, I believe, recently featured on the news. And I would love if you would tell what both of those are and what you're doing right here in our community.
So the big overall umbrella is the WHO project, Whitehall's Help for Overdoses grant that we received. We were the sub-grant awardee from the Franklin County Office of Justice Policy and Programs. And my counterpart at the county's name is Caitlin Looney. She's a rock star, and I've already heard you're going to get with her for a podcast next week. Is that true?
Great, yep.
And then we're going to get back on together for some wraparound?
Absolutely, yes.
That's going to be great. So, anyhow, she's an all-star at what she does. This money was available. It's $400,000. And we were able to be awarded once we wrote the narratives and got together with her and her supervisor. And they really started looking at the demographics of our population and our run statistics and the grand magnitude of this problem here. We were successfully awarded. You couldn't go over 400,000, so we did our best to stay within the boundaries. We received $399,999.55.
Awesome, that's awesome.
I needed the feds to keep that 45 cents. So, you give back when you can.
Yeah.
So, the WHO project was born out of it. And it starts, there's many components to it, but we basically take, in the city of Whitehall, we take a three-headed approach. The first thing that we do is, prevention and harm reduction, and that's where the fire department comes in. That's our specialty. We let the police department do what they're good at, and we do what we're good at. So the harm reduction stuff that we do, we've had town hall meetings. So we had Sam Canones in, and then the WHO team spoke. And then we had, around the back of the room, we had 14 agencies represented, ranging from Franklin County Public Health to Equitas to Prevention Action Alliance, all the different regional assets that we have and resources for family members and people suffering from addiction in the back of the room. At the conclusion of that meeting, we had a brief training on Narcan, and everybody that attended, there was 150, 120, 100, I think there was 150 people total. But not all of them stayed for the after education, but everybody that did received training on how to recognize an overdose, and they received Narcan, and then we also gave them fentanyl test strips, which is something very, very rare in the state of Ohio. In fact, in the country.
Just heard of those, yep.
We are the only fire department in the country that we've heard of. When I bought them from the vendor, first of all, there's two places you can buy them. Only two. And when I bought them from the company out in California, he gave them to me at cost. And he told me that, Chief, you are the only fire department in the country that I've sold these to.
That's great.
And they're controversial. Annie, they just are, because, we were very fortunate. NBC Nightly News came out, and we were on NBC Nightly News this past Sunday. And, one of the big, big stories was, hey, he cornered me and he was like, hey, listen, what do you say to the people that feel that you are giving these fentanyl test strips and helping people break the law? And bottom line, when people say that, they just don't understand.
They just don't get it. That's not it at all.
They are misinformed by misinformed people. I picked that quote up at the last OAKPA keynote speaker. They had somebody in long-term recovery, and he said, misinformed by misinformed people.
Yeah.
I wrote it down. I use it as often as I can. People that are suffering from this disease do not use because they want to have euphoria or feel high. They use to not get sick. And none of us want to take medicine that'll kill us. And that's how I break it down in my head. So all I feel that we're doing is we're giving people a tool to use to test their product because they don't want to die.
Right.
So we do that. We distribute the Project Dawn kits, which I already mentioned. The community paramedic goes out and does talks as often as he can. The second arm of the WHO project is our law enforcement. Law enforcement is good at supply. That's what they do. They're not good at prevention and harm reduction, so we don't ask our officers to do it. Our officers are good at supply, and in the last 2 months alone, they've taken over $1 million of cash, drug money, off the streets, and well over $1 million in drugs itself off the streets of Whitehall. So they're really stepped up their game of enforcement. And then finally, the drug court.
Yeah, right.
We're very proud of the drug court, and it's very odd that, the fire chief, the assistant fire chief is the in charge and coordinating and creating a mayor's drug court. But I've been able to pull it off, and we have 4 participants. Likely we'll have 5 by Tuesday, and they're all 4 participants are doing very well. We have a magistrate, and we have a public defender, and again, incarcerating these people is not what needs to occur. These people need to, they need to be loved. They need to be treated as human beings once again.
That's right.
Because they've likely ostracized themselves from their own families. Mm-hmm. They're the gut-wrenching stories that I've heard over the last 4 months is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then the crown jewel of the project is Safe Stations.
Yes, I love this.
Safe Stations, believe it or not, I heard about it. Caitlin Looney and I, when the grant kicked off, we had to go to Washington, D.C. to learn how to spend federal money. And why we were there, excuse me, we were able to network and listen to other award winners talk about the projects that they were doing and some of the things that they were already doing in their communities. And I kept hearing these buzzwords, safe stations, safe haven, safe places. And every time I heard it, it was coming out of either a parole officer, a police officer. By the way, I was the only fire chief there, and there was over 200 people there. Mm-hmm. I was the only fire chief.
Wow.
Which I think was a travesty.
Well, yeah, and someone's got to blaze the trail.
We the fire department's got to get involved in this problem, right? So anyhow, I kept hearing about these. And so I asked, what's the premise? Well, if you're tired of using, you walk into the police station and we'll get you help. Well, can you think there might be a barrier there?
It might not be that likely.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there's obviously a barrier. Somebody that's in active addiction is not going to walk into the police station with product on them.
And because the first thing, walk in looking for help, and
because they're the cops.
Right. I had an experience where when my son had an injury in football and was prescribed by a surgeon Percocets, and we went through a 6-year nightmare. In the midst of that, my mom is like a little church lady, and she's had a 30-year problem with opiates from a car accident, and it's really robbed her life. But when the problem was surging, I went into a police station, and this was before this was making local news. This was about 2009, 2010. I walked in, and I asked to speak with an officer, and of course I was at the time I thought I was on the clock against my son's death. So I thought, I was so desperate, I didn't want to enable him. I went the opposite route and tried to force consequences. So I went in and tried to figure out a way to have him arrested because I thought he was going to die and I had to stop it. He was about 18 years old. And so I sat down with a police officer and he had a big tablet and he was writing notes of everything I was saying. And I was telling him, my mom's got this problem and she doesn't see an issue with giving my son her prescriptions, and my son's out of control, he's losing weight, he's going to die, is there anything you can do? And he kind of egged the story on and looked really concerned, and afterwards
arrested your mom.
No, I wanted him to, one of them, but then afterwards he said, are you finished, is that all? And I said, yeah. And I was really just so desperate and crazy, I just didn't even think about how it was just foolish of me to even go in without anything structural. And so he turned his notebook around and he said, what does this notebook say? And he had written the word nothing in all capital letters. And I said, oh, it says nothing. And he said, yeah, that's what you've told me. And that's exactly what I'm going to do for you. And I was so traumatized by that. And I'm telling you, I've watched him kind of be promoted up the ranks. And actually, 2 years later, I walked into an opiate event to kind of share and speak, and I saw him there. So I don't know if he's just developed a compassion or come full circle, or maybe he's a hero now in that, but I couldn't continue forward. And I'm not trying to have like a grudge, but that's how far we've come from kind of how families and the situation was dealt with. And that story's still upsetting for me. I tell it sometimes.
It should be.
Yeah.
That's awful.
It's shameful on his part, but I tell it sometimes so people will know. Families are desperate, and they think that their kids are dying, their family members are dying. When they come to you, trusting you, they're just looking for a solution. And I'm so
that's right.
Law enforcement and the fire department are finally stepping in and taking reins in situations like exactly what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that, and that's kind of where it came from, Annie. So I realized in Washington D.C. that this is a barrier. They're not going to go into the police station. So I looked at Caitlin. We were out there in Washington. I said, we're going to do this at the firehouse. And I said, when we get back, we're going to find somebody else that's doing it, and we're going to do it. It took us a week to find any firehouse in the country that was doing this. We finally found one, and it was up in Nassau, Massachusetts. And I called the fire chief up there, and he was very proud of what they had done, and he was very proud of the program. They were able to, the first patient they had was one of the firefighters' brothers that they brought in and took care of and got him linked to treatment. Yep, that's awesome. And then the second patient they had was just somebody that lived in the community, and they were very proud that they were able to help two people in the 2 years the program had been up and running. And I got his documentation, and I noticed the first thing that they did was call the police officers. They called law enforcement, who came to the firehouse, and the first thing they did was ran a warrant check on the person. Well, once that news gets out on the street, how many you think are going to come?
None.
So I looked at the documentation. I'm like, okay, so now I know not what to do, right? I know what not to do. So we just started throwing ideas around, and I finally just put a model down on a piece of paper, and I said, I'm one of those chiefs that's willing to try anything once. Sometimes it's better to beg forgiveness and ask permission. So we're going to do this. And we were fortunate enough to partner up with Maryhaven, with MASC, the Maryhaven Addiction Stabilization Center. I went down and pitched the idea to Will and Andrew, and they fell in love with it. And it's very simple. Anytime, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, somebody can walk into the firehouse and say, I am an active addiction. I'm tired of it. Please help me. We don't run a warrant check. We don't call the police. If you have product on you, we simply take it and destroy it.
I love that.
If you have needles on you, we throw them out. We do everything properly. I bought the chemicals and stuff to dissolve anything that you can throw in there. We've gotten rid of fentanyl lollipops. We've destroyed some crack cocaine, a couple grams of heroin. We've taken and destroyed. Now, somebody walks in here with a kilo, they're going to put me in an ethical dilemma, right? That's let's hope that never happens. But at the end of the day, we go about this. We are non-judgmental, and I think that's one of the key factors. When I take care of them, Randy Jones and I, my community paramedic, we've taken care of 79 people in the last 4 months, just him and I. And the rest of the department, we just took, earlier this morning, we took our 250th person.
That's amazing.
I started seeing it
pop up everywhere online. I would see some of these groups, like the Addicts Parents, or various ones would say, I've got a female this age needing local treatment, and they would give a list of treatment options. But I've started seeing Whitehall Fire Department. Go to the Whitehall Fire Department. Take them there. They'll take you in. They'll check you and hold you and get the ball rolling till then. Not hold you, but you know what I mean. Take care of this person until they can get the ball rolling and get them into treatment. It's like a middleman, because people overdose. A lot of times someone will call a treatment center for themselves to get a bed, and it's 8 days or more. Well, you're probably not going to hear from that person again. That decision's been made, and they overdose in the interim. So to have a middle place to go, that's life-saving.
Yes, and like I say, we take them in, and we do a brief screening on them. We make a phone call, and as long as they pass our screening and they're medically stable, and you know, when we say mentally stable, that's a relative term. You know, there are usually most people in addiction are suffering from co-diagnoses, right? They're also suffering with some type of mental disorder, and that's okay. We just have to make sure they're not in mental crisis at that time, because what they're about to go through, they're going to need as much stamina as they can, because they're going to get detoxed.
Yep.
But we're very proud of it, Annie.
And then they start to deal with the trauma and the emotions that, you know, their life has had.
That's right. And we're very proud of it. Like I say, in 4 months, we've been able to transport 250 people. And what we're most proud of, I got the numbers right here in front of me. What we're most proud of is 52.05% has what we call a positive outcome. And we've determined that we've used the industry standard. So here's what's happened. 52% of those people. So 125 of those 250 people, or 126 of them, they have made it through detox. They have made it through some length of residential stay, can be anywhere from 7 to 28 days. And then they were all linked to sober living or recovery housing or IOP or OP, whatever their particular case manager needs. They've also all been given insurance. That's the other big one. We don't ask if you have insurance.
Yeah.
We make zero money on this. Nothing. Zero money on this. We put them, if I'm here, I put them in my chief's car and I take them if I, you know, as often as I can, because, you know, as an administrator, I don't get to ride the trucks. I don't get to feel that warmth that comes from helping people. You know, we all have those, everybody that does this job has those demons that you don't ever want to think about again. But then we all have those warm stories that you can never forget because of how it makes you feel to help, truly help somebody. And as an administrator, to come up with a program like this, I think that's why my passion is so great on it, because I am seeing not just numbers. I can see the success in the numbers. That's easy. But I can see the successes on people's faces. Right. I mean, the gut-wrenching. Had a father in here. Oh, boy. He was close to a month ago, and his daughter had been gone for 6 months. She had been using for 6 years. She was 22. She left the house when she was 17. And she's been back and forth, but they hadn't seen her in 6 months. And it was right when they had a surge at the Hilltop. They had a surge down in Tent City. They had a surge somewhere else. And he was worried sick.
Where's our Tent City?
It's down south.
Okay.
And one of them anyway. And this man he sat in my office. We screened her. She was a female. We had to wait for a bed. So I said, let's just come in and sit in my office. We'll talk. And I got her a glass of water, asked her if she wanted something to eat. I was going to make her a peanut butter sandwich. And she said no. But we started talking. And this father, he just sat there and just cried. And he said, you have no idea. For the last 6 months, I have, because she got up to go to the bathroom. Of course, I asked her, you know, I need to look at your pockets and stuff. I didn't want her going in our bathroom and using. Yeah. So she was clean.
Yeah.
So she's in the bathroom. He just looked at me and said, Chief, you know, you have no idea what this means to me. He says, for 6 straight months, I've gone to work. I've come home. I've ate supper. I filled my pickup truck full of gas, and I drive until it's a quarter tank every night.
Wow.
Sometimes I'm out till 1 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes I'm out till 2 o'clock in the morning, and I look for my little girl.
Wow.
And he said, I found her 3 days ago, and she was so high and she was so out of it that he pulled over to the curb. She stuck her head in his window when he rolled it down and solicited him for $50.
Wow.
And he just looked at her and said, baby girl, get in the truck. That's his own daughter.
Family pain.
Gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
You know, it's just gut-wrenching. We had 31-year-old in here the other day. She's 31 years old. She's been addicted. She's been suffering an addiction for 16 years, and she's pregnant. And she's 8 months pregnant. And she, believe it or not, she was taking prenatal vitamins. But she was also using heroin, right?
Well, there's still so many good qualities deep inside them. I mean, the good of
that's
the
why I'm,
in there.
Absolutely. She knows. And she just cried and cried and cried on our way down. And I said, you know, and I called her by name. I said, what's wrong? And she said, I want a chance to raise one of my babies.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how many children do you have? Now, remember, she's 31. This is her 10th child.
Oh, my goodness.
And she hasn't raised any of them. They've all been taken from her.
Wow.
So they're just gut-wrenching stories. I mean, you know, and the longer I do this and the longer I network with those of you that specialize in addiction and recovery, the more respect and the more amped up I get about being part of it, because, you know, I'll throw as much energy at this as we need to, because I'm proud that we've helped 250 people start on their way to recovery. I'm proud that I got to go down to Equitas and help pass out clean needles during the exchange program. You know, there's another gut-wrenching story. You're down there, you're passing out needles. I asked the woman if she minded, and she said, no, go ahead and ask me some questions. I got to go back in the exam room when they were talking to her, and I called her by name, of course, and I said, how much do you use a day? And she said, 20, 40 points, which is about a half a gram. And I said, yeah, okay. And I said, then why do you need 100 needles? I said, do you shoot up twice a day? She said, yeah, sometimes three. I stretch it to three. And I said, well, you gonna come back next week? And she said, well, yeah. And I said, well, then why not take 25 needles? Why take 100? Because that's the max they'll give. And she looked at me. She didn't miss a beat. And she said, well, sir, If I give the guy I'm staying with 5 clean needles, I don't have to give him something else.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just stood there. And I was like, oh, my God.
I mean, that's what they have to manage in their life.
So if people don't think that this plague is linked to human trafficking, they're kidding themselves.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, no. It desperately is.
Absolutely.
You know, you do have such a drive and a compassion, and you just remind me, I usually ask people just because, but you remind me of Chief Deputy Rick Minard. We had him on the podcast. When he came on, he has such a passion and a drive for the HOPE Task Force, which helps a lot of families. And he talks about how there will be an overdose and then somebody will go back and talk to the family and offer resources, counseling, ministry. And when they're used to, you know, freeze, hands up, they're given compassion. And I had asked him, do you have this in your family? And he said, no, I just had my eyes opened and I had an awakening from being around you and these families and the addicts, parents, and all of these organizations that are such good people, fine people. These parents are, you know, from good families, coach their kids' sports teams, took their kids to church every weekend. They're fine people that are passionate and struggling and loyal to each other. And he said, I just started being around these families and it made me want to get on board with this epidemic. And I just, you know, I don't know if you even understand how much that matters, because my son's 6 years in recovery now. I know what it's like, you know, like with that police officer, and I wish him well, forgive or whatever, but we know what it's like to be shunned and judged and blamed and looked down on. And we are so desperately grateful when somebody has authentic, true compassion and support that is not just blowing smoke.
That's right. And first of all, Chief Deputy Minard he's a great guy, right?
Yeah.
And he does have a lot of passion. And he's also very lucky not to have touched his family or his social circle. Many of us can't say that, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I know that a lot of my passion comes from that angle. And a lot of it also comes from learning and understanding. And once I got inside of the science of addiction and the dopamine yeah. receptors. And once I, you know, cause I was one of those geeks in paramedic school that actually liked the acid base balance lecture and stuff like that, because I like to truly understand the pathophys of a disease pattern so that I can, it helps me treat it in the back of the medic truck. And at the end of the day, you know, this is what our community is asking us to do. As public safety officials, we all take an oath. And, you know, sometimes they want us to run into a house and into a room that's 450, 600 degrees. Sometimes they need us to do resuscitation on a four-year-old. But what they're asking us to do now is help them with this epidemic. And we have to. And I heard that calling. I also have a pretty strong faith structure. My wife and I are longtime members of the Catholic Church there in Mount Vernon. And I truly believe that this is a calling, and all of you and all of us, I feel confident that I've done enough now that I think that I'm fortunate enough that I can consider myself part of the recovery scheme now in addiction, and you have to have some faith too, you know. I learned real early in my career, you know, that this job will either make you believe in God or do the exact opposite, right? And I can't, without faith, I don't know how people process that. So I think it's very important to work some type of faith aspect into the wraparound. And, you know, just the families that have been touched and impacted, you know, I think programs like this are truly making a difference. You know, obviously you're very well educated. You've done everything right. You've checked all the boxes, and you had had to go through a living heck
yeah.
with your son, right? You, but again, the stigma, we have to continue to concentrate on the stigma. And that's what I tell my guys. This is not, you know, because I got to be honest with you, I got some crusties, right? Yeah. We work on the east side of Columbus.
Crusties.
We wear ballistic vests a lot. My guys are hardcore at what they do. And we run in some, it's kind of dangerous once in a while, right?
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, when they say, Chief, I woke that woman up three times yesterday. Three different times I woke up the same woman that she overdosed.
Yeah.
She overdosed, I woke her up, I took her to hospital, she signed out AMA. She overdosed, I woke her up, she took her to hospital, she signed on AMA, and I woke her up again. How many times do you need me to wake her up? And I don't miss a beat. I look right back at him and said, well, I don't know, bub. How many times would you want me to wake up your daughter in a day?
That's the exact truth. That's the response I give. I had somebody say the same thing to me a couple weeks ago. His son's a sheriff's deputy. And he said, you know, how many times are they supposed to do that? And I said, you look at it a lot different when it's your son, you know, and we're all connected to this problem. And just because you think it hasn't, or maybe it hasn't closely touched you, we're all, it's possible in any family, and it's connecting all of us.
We had I took a young girl down. This one was last week. This is another real good one. And she grew up in one of the more affluent regions of the county. She grew out on the fringe of the community. She had horses. For her 18th birthday, she received an Arabian horse. Arabian.
Wow.
Exactly. Wow. Right. And she was on the equestrian team. She went to college on the equestrian team, and she fell off a horse. She got hurt, and she started on the perks, then the Vicodin, and then she got cut off, and then she started buying them on the street. And then once she had sold enough stuff and ostracized the stuff herself, she moved into heroin, and she's been addicted to heroin now for the last 6 years. This drug, this epidemic that we started, I am convinced that we started ourselves in this country because of a few factors.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it did. Her parents of 29 years divorced. They lost everything trying to help her. Yep. No more horse farm, no more thoroughbreds. The marriage ended. It was very brutal. She doesn't have a relationship with either one of them. And, you know, she's in my car just crying because she said, 6 years ago, I was on a scholarship on the equestrian team at a prestigious college. And now I'm couch surfing.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out what I'm going to do for my fix the next day. And it's just gut wrenching, man. And like you say, the stigmas, we got to work on the stigma still, but I do think there's hope. I do see us making a concerted effort. I'm very proud of the response in Franklin County. Had the opportunity to go down to the state house. And one of the representatives was, starting a new bill. So I got to go down and speak on behalf of the bill that he's putting towards the floor. And he, you know, he's trying to think he wants a drug czar. And, you know, I don't know what we need, what we don't need at that level. I think it would be great. I'm a paramilitary guy, right? Grew up in a fire service, but at the end of the day, the enemy's more organized than we are. Mm-hmm. We are making decisions based, and we're doing it in silos. We're doing this program here. We're doing that program there. We're doing this program over here. And nobody's really coordinating them.
And they're very coordinated, and they're ahead of the game, and they advance. I mean, especially if you read Dreamland, they have a business model that includes technology, oh, yeah. Social media, and transportation.
I mean, it's pizza delivery.
Right.
And it's just an unending stream of employees. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think we're going to turn the tide on this one. I do think we're going to, because you're going to get more fire departments involved. You're going to get more public safety agents involved. There's going to be more beds open up in Ohio, and we're going to get out of this. The prescription medication, you know, they say we're getting better, but don't forget in 2016, we still in the state of Ohio filled, not prescribed, filled enough prescriptions for every man, woman, and child in the state to have 3 weeks worth of a narcotic pain medication. So I know we're getting better, but we did this.
Yeah.
We threw pills at patients. We created pill mills. And I can remember when it happened. I've taught paramedic school for years. And I can remember sitting down to the new curriculum put down by the state of Ohio and said, hey, we got a new vital sign. It's the pain scale. I said, what? Right. Yeah, pain's now a vital sign. And I'm like, well, pain can't kill you. Why do we care? And then our society, we take it another step. And Sam talks about this a little bit, but I do think he did miss a little bit, and he could have really ran with it. As a society, we're, in my opinion, we don't want, it's not good enough for us not just to feel pain. We don't want any pain.
That's it.
But we want to feel euphoric.
Yeah.
When you break your ankle, it's going to hurt, man. And it's okay.
Cold, it's going to be unbearable for a while, but you'll live if you'll, you know, power through it.
Power through it. Don't take the oxys that they send you home with.
Right.
Dentists are some of the worst.
But that's hard for somebody who's got that compulsion. And, I firmly believe hospitals and some of these physicians will kill somebody addicted. I had heard on a podcast recently that a man who works in the recovery industry had a snowboarding accident and hurt his knee. And the emergency room physician had insisted he needed some kind of, you know, pain medication. And he kept saying, you don't understand, we're going to be in a lot more trouble if I take pain medication. And he said, well, I at least need to give you liquid Valium. And he said, as soon as that medication hit my bloodstream, my first thought was, I wonder if I can still buy dope at McCarthy Park.
Yep.
Like that powerful. And it's hard for them to turn it down. And these physicians need to know you're dealing with something that's a lot more, it's a powerful, baffling, cunning disorder.
That's right. And instead of the narcotic, let's give a Nubane or a Toradol or something. Let's give a drug that has no euphoric effect. None. but it'll still help with the pain. Let's just give an analgesic. Give them Versed. That doesn't take pain away. You just don't care. Oh, my God, that hurts. Who cares? That's what it does. You forget about it as soon as it happens. But instead, you know, we're content with 115 people in America dying every day. Every 12 minutes. Every 12 minutes in this country, somebody dies.
That's right. And I know somebody who's been addicted. You know, I'm not, you know, invalidating anything that's authentic injury or pain, but, you know, I know how the addict brain works. Somebody who's been addicted easily can find their way to an injury or a medical necessity with their teeth or something like that, and easily find their way to a prescription if they want to. And sometimes it just seems ironic that they often do. And these, you know, the doctors need to be aware of how to handle these people that have activated the chemistry within them that craves these opiates.
That's correct. And, you know, there's all kinds of evaluation tools. All the doctors would have to do is run the person through a quick screening and see where they fall on the level of are they a candidate that could be addicted, right? There's precursors. There's tools out there. And then if they are, don't give it to them. Send them home with, hey, you're still going to have some pain. Elevate your ankle. Put some ice on it. Take the prescription strength ibuprofen, you're going to live.
Yeah, and then set some goals. Set some goals to go, you know, walking or journaling or, you know, write a book. Yep. Or, you know, set some goals and start powering toward those instead of concentrating on what pain needs to be relieved.
I agree 100%.
Well, I got to have you on again because I want to hear so much more about your experiences and your work. So we'll make that happen. And I want to come support all of the events you're doing in the city. I'm sure you're seeing once families latch on to the fact that you're not only compassionate, but you're understanding and supportive and active, we will rally around you. I'm sure you're catching on to that. So we all want to support
Yes.
your work. And I honestly feel, I always say, you know, Ohio's called the heart of it all. And the epidemic, you know, allegedly began in Ohio. The problem started in Portsmouth. There was a first fentanyl overdose here. But the first recovery meeting also occurred here in 1938. I personally believe that hope is going to spring from Ohio, from situations like your safe station.
You know, I couldn't agree more because Ohio is also responsible. When you see it in your field, I definitely see it in the pre-hospital care. Ohio has some of the most respected and highly intensively, they can treat patients. They have some of the best hospitals. We have some of the best hospitals in the country, specifically here in Franklin County. And it's just a hotbed of top level care from everything from, again, musculoskeletal injuries right up to the schizophrenic co-diagnoses along with having a heroin addiction. So we are blessed with that team in our state, and we're responsible. I believe that Ohioans rally to the cause, yep. And we're not going to settle for being the second leading state. Our overdose rate is double the national average, and it's tripled since 2010.
Yeah.
We're not going to settle for that. The one other stat I want to read, because I picked this one up when Caitlin and I were out in Washington, D.C. And when you have us on together, her and I have quite a few other gigs planned up for over the winter, and we're going to get to teach in Washington, D.C. next spring when we go out there. But I picked this one up. For every one death that's in Ohio and the rest of the country, 10 other people are admitted for treatment. 32 people visit the emergency rooms for an overdose. 130 people actually become addicted. And 825 people, 825 people begin to use opioids in a recreational atmosphere. For every Ohio death, and we are up to 668 in Franklin County in the last 2 years. So, it's very sobering.
It is.
It's a heavy discussion, but, you know, you take one life at a time. You touch one family at a time. That's what I tell people. When we give Narcan, We don't save people. We keep families together. And that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah. And it's one family at a time, and it's one son or daughter. Every single person out there is someone's son or daughter. And that's how I started phrasing it. When somebody would see someone panhandling or hear that somebody got into trafficking and they talked about him with kind of a trashy tone, I'd say that's someone's son. That's still someone's daughter. You don't know what that parent's not deserving it. They're going through this too. And most of us are going through it sober. You know,
that's right.
One son or daughter at a time. And, you know, I do believe that hope is going, the tide will start turning here. Ohioans are fighters, and we have grit. You know, I mean, we're used to sometimes having four seasons in the same week. We know how to get through tough time.
You know, That's true.
I think we're going to rally, and it's going to start with programs like yours. So I can't encourage you, support you, and thank you enough.
I appreciate it. I really do. I just enjoy the opportunity. Talk about it, because we are proud of it. You know, it is really nice to see the guys rally around something like this, and it's just great. It's just great to be able to help the forgotten, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. The
you know,
the downtrodden, and that includes their family members, because we get it too.
I mean, it just, again, gut-wrenching. You know, a little girl came in, and she was living in the woods right at the outskirts of town, and there was a house on the corner. She gave me the address. I said, I asked if I could have the address, because I went over and shook the hands of that resident and told him that I helped that woman, that they had been helping. But 2 to 3 days a week, the family would take their leftovers from their kitchen table for supper, and they literally put it in a bowl and they put it on the back porch.
Oh God.
And she came out of the woods and ate it.
And that's someone's daughter. It's still someone's
That's somebody's daughter.
That's right. Someone's granddaughter, somebody's niece.
That's a granddaughter. That's right.
That's right. And, so we got to get them one at a time, and you put our can, and you give food, and you give encouragement. It doesn't mean roll over and accept bad behavior, but it means be compassionate and loving one person at a time, because you never know
that's
when
right.
it's someone you care about.
That's right. It's going to touch you.
No,
if it hasn't touched your family, it's going to.
That's the way
I look at it.
I have not had this problem in my face in 6 years, but I still treat every one of them like I would want my son handled if he were out there. He could easily be out there again. I want him handled with mercy and like he's human. So
that's
I believe that's the tide turning here. And again, I can't thank you enough. I'm going to have you on again. Is there any way that our listeners can email you, social media? Do you have any kind of contact point?
So email address is christopher.menapace@whitehall-oh.us. If you go to the City of Whitehall's Facebook page, you could find me that way. You could instant message me. I'm on Facebook. The Whitehall Division of Fire has its own Facebook page. You can message me that way, or just put something out there. I can get a hold of you. Or you can call the firehouse. Just call the Whitehall Division of Fire at 614-237-0831.
And if you or someone you know has someone needing detox or struggling with this problem, you now know a safe station they can go to, and they will be warmly welcomed. Again, I thank you so much. And until next time, I wish everyone well. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Addiction Nonfiction. Views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this episode by the guests belong solely to the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the host or any affiliated organization or institution. You may contact host Annie at annieunhooked@gmail.com. We hope you'll keep coming back to listen to Addiction Nonfiction.